We've heard how, due to the preaching of Vidura, that Dhritarashtra, along with Gandhari, has left Hastinapur for the north, for the Himalayas. Vidura, from his own powerful experience, has taught Dhritarashtra and everyone ultimately in the palace and without the palace that one should not depend on the external circumstance. To do so would be quite an intoxication. One would have to be in an intoxicated, illusion state to do so. Because everything in the material world will fail. It must fail. It is designed to fail, to let us down. So to take shelter of that which is temporary, that will crumble, is certainly an illusion, or one in illusion is the type of person who will do that. Only one in illusion. Vidura would have preferred that Dhritarashtra become a Narottam, which is someone who fully depends upon Krishna. Practically, this is a Paramhamsa, or a Paripajakacharya. And everyone is needed to do this, to learn this art of full dependence upon Krishna. By the time that they leave this world, sometimes I think of it as an hourglass with the sand pouring slowly at its own pace through the small central person part of the hourglass. So we have a mission that before the sand of our life runs out, before we have used up our life's breath, it is in our interest to have learned this very simple to understand art, but very hard to apply to our own lives, the art of full dependence on Krishna. Because when our body is completely failing us and our voice, our throat is choked up, mucus is in our lungs, we can't breathe, the body is offering us so much pain, the heart stopping, how much distress there will be in the body, and therefore how much distress will there be in the mind? And at that time, unless we are really well practiced to depend upon Krishna, how will we possibly do it? Because now, when my mind is peaceful, then sometimes I can think, Krishna, Krishna, whatever happens, it's all right, I'm depending upon you. But in a distressed condition, when my mind is disturbed, it's so difficult. How will I be able to do this at the time of death unless I am fully practiced now? So sometimes we wonder how renounced we should be, as Prabhu was mentioning yesterday. As we get older, people are even telling us, you know, that renunciation is from when you're young, you deserve something, you've worked so hard right now. And yes, it's a fact that we shouldn't take less than we actually need. Excuse me, we shouldn't take less than we actually need, because that will cause another distress to the mind. But on the other side, it is in our interest to not take more than we need either. Because if we're habituated to taking so much and have all the excuses, yes, because of this reason I need this, and because of this reason I need this, and because of this. And it may be true, but then what will we do at the time of death? Will we tell Yamaraj, of course, for the devotees here, they won't be seeing Yamaraj. But yet the distress will be so great, there will be no excuse that we can offer if we want to get the best result. No excuse will be sufficient. We have to, not have to in the sense of we must, and someone external is forcing us, but have to in the sense of it's in our best interest to have practiced this art of not depending on those things in the material world that everyone naturally depends upon, but to minimize our external dependence for the purpose of maximizing our dependence upon Krishna. It is in our own interest. But yet, if we try to artificially give up things that we even need and cause our mind so much distress by doing that, that will be another type of maya, illusion, or trouble. Because the mind won't be able to focus on Krishna, which is the purpose of it all, to practice focusing on Krishna, surrendering to Him fully in all circumstances. So this, to do this properly, takes a cool head and a balanced mind. And of course, it should be done under, like everything else, consultation, under guidance of, we heard about Yudhisthira's reign again, that it was done under the guidance of the Brahmins, the Shastra, the Sadhu, Shastra, Guru, and in the mode of goodness. Without being in the mode of goodness, no matter how hard we try, we will not be able to become neutral in relationship to the material world, because passion will force us. This is what passion does, force desires within our mind, forces. So depend upon the Lord only was really the message of Vidura. But Dhritarashtra, due to having been offensive to Vaishnavas, could not come to the platform of Narottam, but rather the platform of Dhira, of sobriety, not depending upon that which is illusory, giving that up, illusory dependence. At least he was able to do that and take steps towards the platform of full dependence of Krishna. So they're in a dependent relationship. There are two parties. One is the depender, the one who is depending, and then there is the dependent, and then the person who is being depended upon. The children are depending. They're dependent upon the parents. And as we know, who is more attached in that relationship? The one on top, attached, because it is the one who is dependent. Generally, he'll be looking to become independent. And as we have seen with 16-year-old kids in the West or whatever, as soon as they can become independent, they do it. 16, 17, 18, or whatever. But the parents are the ones who maintain the attachment even stronger. I can even say this from my own experience. The parents are more attached. So out of these two parts of the relationship, which one did we just hear about, the preaching towards? We heard the preaching towards the one who is dependent, Dhritarashtra. We heard the preaching, don't be dependent on anyone but Krishna. Don't become dependent on that which is illusory. Depend ultimately on the Lord. So now we will hear about the other side of the relationship. Don't think that you have the power to give shelter to another. Another type of illusion, still a stronger one. Narada Muni had just arrived, and Yudhisthira and Sanjay were in so much anxiety. Why? Because these two were being depended upon. They had taken their responsibility as their responsibility to give shelter and protection to Dhritarashtra. And now he was gone, and Narada is going to preach to them. Sri Narada said, O pious king, do not lament for anyone, for everyone is under the control of the Supreme Lord. Therefore, all living beings and their leaders carry on worship to be well protected. It is he only who brings them together and disperses them. So what were the fears of Sanjay and Yudhisthira Maharaj? What was a fear, for example? Yes. Yes. Yeah, Dhritarashtra, because of our not taking care of him, he has run away and drowned himself in the Ganges. That's cool. That one. Huh? So what else were they fearing for him? Animals in the jungle, the ferocious tigers in the Himalayan mountains would gobble him up. And after all, he's blind. So many fears. He'll get sick, no one to care for him. So Narada's first words say, do not lament for anyone. Who is caring for everyone? Everyone is under the control of the Supreme Lord. Purport. Every living being, either in this material world or in the spiritual world, is under the control of the Supreme Lord, the personality of Godhead. Beginning from Brahmaji, the leader of this universe, down to the insignificant ant, all are abiding by the order of the Supreme Lord. No one can escape this binding of the Lord's control by even the smallest amount. Thus, the constitutional position of the living being is subordinate under the control of the Lord. The foolish living being, especially man, artificially rebels against the law of the Supreme Lord, of the Supreme, and thus becomes chastised as an asura, or lawbreaker. A living being is placed in a particular position by the order of the Supreme Lord, and he is again shifted from that place by the order of the Supreme Lord or his authorized agents. Brahma, Shiva, Indra, Chandra, Maharaj Yudhisthira, or in modern history, Napoleon, Akbar, Alexander, Gandhi, Subhash, and Nehru are all servants of the Lord, and they are placed in and removed from their respective positions by the supreme will of the Lord. None of them is independent, even though such men or leaders rebel so as not to recognize the supremacy of the Lord. They are put under still more, even though such men or leaders rebel so as not to recognize the supremacy of the Lord, they are put under still more rigorous laws of the material world by different miseries. Only the foolish man, therefore, says that there is no God. Maharaj Yudhisthira was being convinced of this naked truth because he was greatly overwhelmed by the sudden departure of his old uncles and aunt. Maharaj Dhritarashtra was placed in that position according to his past deeds. He had already suffered or enjoyed the benefits accrued to him in the past, but due to his good luck, somehow or other, he had a good younger brother, Vidura. And by his instructions, he left to achieve salvation by closing all accounts in the material world. So if we accept that Krishna is the supreme controller and that there is nothing that we can do, that takes away all impetus for action. Should one truly, if one is sick, shouldn't one take medicine? If one is poor, shouldn't one work? If one sees someone attacking him, shouldn't one defend himself, or just the mercy of Krishna, whatever happens? No, in the bhakti tradition, the devotees are always active. But how should they act? The next verse describes the actions. As a cow bound through the nose by a long rope is conditioned, so also human beings are bound by different Vedic injunctions and are conditioned to obey the orders of the Supreme. So directly applying that to the position of aspiring devotees, one should do his duty. That's how one should act. And how does one learn one's duty? From Shastra Guru, Shastra Sadhu. So not that because Krishna is in control, therefore we don't have to do anything. But this point has come up many times. But we shouldn't over-endeavor, try to jump over Krishna's control. So when it talks about, when in Shastra it talks about that Prabhupada mentions in purports to the Bhagavad Gita that even when the devotee leaves one's bodily maintenance to the Lord and he depends upon the Lord for everything. No, the devotee, this is the material world, I heard Prabhupada say. One should work, one should live simply and grow some food, but no factories. So to know what is a proper endeavor and what is an over-endeavor, an inappropriate over-endeavor, takes some maturity and spiritual wisdom, and that takes guidance. When Prabhupada, I think one of his first disciples that died, Jayananda Prabhu, left this world in Prabhupada's presence. Not that he was, Prabhupada was sitting there as he left the world, but while Prabhupada was still on this earth. So Jayananda had leukemia, but he was a very bold person, and he had been given $10,000 by his parents to get some chemotherapy, to make the attempt to prolong his life and possibly even cure the leukemia. And his reaction was to take that money and give it to Prabhupada, saying, what is the use of maintaining such a useless body, such a body that's so doomed anyway? So he was so detached, and Prabhupada was very proud of him. And he said, it is an honor to have a disciple like this. Not that because Prabhupada wanted the $10,000 specifically, and therefore that was the honor, but that detachment and that dependence on Krishna. Therefore it was judged by Jayananda, although he did so many things to attempt a cure, and a devotee will do that because his body is meant for service. And especially devotees who have been around a long time, they carry with them a wealth of experience that it may take someone else, it takes 30 years to get. So it's not cheap. So a devotee will take care of himself, but that doesn't become the focus of his life. And at some point, it becomes an over-endeavor. And it's not worth it. Okay, this is my fate. I accept it. There was one other Mataji, Goridasi, who was a book distributor. A very powerful person. Very strong. Physically, mentally, spiritually. And she came to Vrindavan to leave the world. She had cancer too. This was many years ago, and possibly in the 80s. Yes, in the 80s. And then miraculously she got better, and she went out and did one more book marathon in Los Angeles in December of some year. Then she came back to Vrindavan, and she was always fighting it. She went to this doctor and this doctor and this doctor and this doctor, and then really, because Daktrini Mataji was taking care of her, was helping with Vidya, Mataji, taking care of her. And it wasn't until 3 days before this Mataji Gauri left this world that she actually accepted it. Yes, now I'm going to die. Because she was powerful and she was struggling and trying to get this cure and that cure. But then she accepted it. And then she became peaceful. So at some point, if one knows one's fate is to be poor, one will struggle somewhat and somewhat, and then one sees, this is my fate. So he won't over-endeavor. He'll just accept, okay, here, this is my position. How can I use it in Krishna's service? How can I be satisfied with that? So there is endeavor that is appropriate, and then there is over-endeavor. Not that we just sit back only and wait for Krishna to put the food in our mouth, and then wait for Krishna to move our mouth up and down to chew it. And when Krishna wants the food to go down, he'll allow us to swallow, he'll make us swallow. But from then on, it is automatic by Krishna. So one should do his duty. Even though Krishna is in control, one should do his duty according to Shastra. And one should endeavor in all things, but recognize what Krishna is actually telling us as well, and thereby know what over-endeavor is. So very strong preaching to Yudhisthira. He's saying, you're in so much anxiety and lamenting, but who do you think you are? Who's actually in control? Is it you or is it Krishna? Who has been protecting Dhritarashtra all along? Is it you or has it been Krishna? Listen to this verse, 43. As a player sets up and disperses his playthings according to his own sweet will, so the supreme will of the Lord brings men together and separates them. This is what the older one gets, I think, the more one feels like this, that less depends upon us and our endeavor, and more just depends on this whimsical player who does things as he wants, and there's nothing anyone can do about it. He gives, he takes as he wants, and there's nothing that can be done. One just has to surrender to him, and yet without being angry at him or too angry at him, just keep on serving him with devotion. Prabhupada's purport. We must know for certain that the particular position in which we are now set up is an arrangement of the supreme will in court in terms of our own acts in the past. So if it's karma in accordance with our own acts in the past, what does the supreme will have to do with it? So we know, of course, that Krishna is the anumanta, and the permitter, the sanctioner. Bharta bhokta maheshwara paramatmati chapyukto dehismin purushaparam upadrashta anumanta cha. He is the overseer and the permitter. So in one sense, he sanctions everything. So in that sense, we can say that that our situation is set up ultimately by him. But there's another sense as well. And that other sense is that we have a certain amount, each and every one of us have a certain amount of karma for this life. And what is that called? Parabdha karma. Yes. But yet, that parabdha karma is, say, this much, and the upper of the karma, the total amount of karma that's actually due to us, is an incredibly huge amount. And yet we get a pinch for this life. So out of this huge, huge mountain of karma, because just imagine, say if anyone in any life has ever killed a cow, hopefully no one has ever done this, or taken part in that. So what is the karma for killing a cow? hair, every hair one birth, yes? So for say if it took someone did some horrible act like that, and it took him, say, a half hour. But how much karma did he accrue for that half hour work, that deed? Millions and millions and millions of years of karma. So in one life, perhaps we accrue billions of years of karma. So after a billion lives, what to speak of the countless lives we have, how big is the mountain of karma that we're carrying around as aparabdha karma? And therefore, compared to that, what do we get in this life? We get one pinch. So in addition to Krishna sanctioning, but ultimately, Krishna decides on which pinch we get. Because there's unlimited karma, so what we get for one life is also Krishna's mercy or Krishna's desire. So in that sense, the particular position we are now set up is an arrangement of the supreme will in terms of our own acts in the past. So who is satisfied with their current position? I won't ask anyone to raise their hands because, very good, very Krishna conscious. I won't raise my hand because I have a long list of things I would prefer to be quite different. Maybe you did understand because that's a wonderful answer. Yes, you're satisfied. But very rare is actually anyone satisfied with their current position. If one is satisfied, really, that means jivatiyo mukti pade siddhaya bhak. They accept when something happens to them, they accept, okay, Krishna arranged this. Okay. Even though there's pain involved, okay, I'm willing to take that pain, accept it, swallow it, chew it. Oh, we should chew it before we swallow it. Taste it. That's the one I was looking for. Taste the pain. Chew it. Swallow it. Digest it. Okay. Who is willing to do that? If you raise your hand now, then it's very good. But you have to remember it next time something happens you don't like. I remember one time, Atreya Rishi Prabhu, an old devotee, was born in Iran. So most of the devotees on the GBC were American. But he was born in Iran, even though educated, very educated, Harvard University. But he thought somewhat differently from most of the devotees, and it was hard for them to understand him. So one time he was talking to someone that he was fighting with, and he said, "You are my guru." And they couldn't figure out what he was talking about, which is basically what we're supposed to do when we call each other Prabhu. And what he was saying, indirectly, he was saying, "You're teaching me so many things, especially tolerance. I'm accepting this. This is my karma. Okay. Krishna is teaching me through you." That's what guru means. Krishna is teaching me through you. But one has to have a certain receptivity to Krishna's message. If we consider that we are living in the mercy of Krishna, Mayeva Mana Adatsva, Mayam Buddhim Navesha, Naveshashi, Mayeva Turvana Samsaya, if one has his mind fixed in this way, seeing Krishna in everything, accepting everything, then we'll see as Dattatreya Muni in the 11th canto, we'll see gurus everywhere. Krishna will teach us in so many ways. But one has to be very, very surrendered and serious to have Krishna teach him in that way. We must know for certain that the particular position in which we are now set up is an arrangement of the Supreme Will in terms of our own acts in the past. Even on this one day, today, accept this simple first sentence of this purport to Bhagavatam 1.13.43, and see how many times in this one day Krishna will teach you directly and what he wants you to learn. The Supreme Lord is present as the localized Paramatma in the heart of every living being, as it is said in the Bhagavad Gita 13.23, and therefore he knows everything of our activities and every stage of our lives. He rewards the reactions of our actions by placing us in some particular place. A rich man gets his son born with a silver spoon in his mouth, but the child who came as the rich man's son deserves such a place, and therefore he is placed there by the will of the Lord. At a particular moment when the child has to be removed from that place, he is also carried by the will of the Supreme, even if the child or the father does not wish to be separated from the happy relation. The same thing happens in the case of a poor man also. Neither rich man nor poor man has any control over such meetings or separations of living beings. Very hard to accept this, especially for the one who is being depended upon. So his preaching is very strong. Be detached. You're not the Supreme. O King, in all circumstances, whether you consider the soul to be an eternal principle, if you consider the soul to be eternal, then what can be lamented about? Just like in the Bhagavad Gita, in the second chapter. Then what can happen to an eternal soul? Or if you consider the material body to be perishable, if you consider him to be the material body, then it's inevitable. Why lament over a loss of a bulk of chemicals? You're afraid that he's going to die? What's the worst thing that's going to happen to Dhritarashtra? He's going to die? Well, do you think that an eternal soul can die? Do you think a material body can be saved? Or everything to exist in the impersonal absolute truth? If you believe that, there is nothing to lament about. Or everything to be an inexplicable combination of matter and spirit? In any case, whatever your philosophy is, feelings of separation are due only to illusory affection and nothing more. And therefore, tams titikshasvabharatayu. Therefore, give up your anxiety due to ignorance of the self. You are now thinking of how they who are helpless poor creatures will exist without you. Well, who's been maintaining him the whole time? Do you think it's been you? Who is Bhuta Brit? Prabhupada will explain in the purport. The Lord is known as the Bhuta Brita, the protector, the maintainer of every living entity. No one else but the Supreme Lord can give protection to anyone. So much Bhagavad Gita preaching here. This is one of my favorite of these very strong verses, 46. Kalakam aguna dino deho yam panchabhautika katam anyams to gopayet sapo grasto yata param. This gross material body made of the five elements is already under the control of eternal time, kala, action, karma, and the modes of material nature, guna. That means your body, Yudhisthira. How can your body, which is under the control of karma and time and guna, how can you, therefore, being already in the jaws of the serpent, protect others? You're in the jaws of the serpent of time, and you're worrying about someone in the jaws of the serpent of time? Prabhupada's purport to 46. So this type of preaching is preaching to awaken detachment within the heart. There's in the third canto of the Bhagavatam and in the fourth canto of the Bhagavatam, there are specific chapters that are so heavy to awaken detachment and renunciation within the heart. This type of preaching is meant for that. In the previous sections, there was preachings how to awaken attachment to Krishna in the heart. Just hear Krishna's sweet dealings with his devotees. Just hear them. How Krishna protects, how sweetly and wonderfully he deals. But these chapters, because unless we become detached from matter, how will we become attached to Krishna? So which chapters in the third canto really awaken detachment? Yes, which chapters in Kapiladeva? Yes. And the next chapter, which is actions of fruit of activities. Because you see life in its cycles. Because now something, we're attached to someone, or something miserable happens. But in 30 years from now, we'll view it completely differently. We may have forgotten it, as well as our happiness. So when we see the perspective, change our perspective, then everything changes. Another chapter in the third canto, description of time from the atom. It changes our perspective, just like we sometimes when class goes on a long time, everyone goes like this, you know, without or out of the corner of their eye, they look at the clock, how many more minutes? Because 10 minutes seems like such a long time sometimes. But then what happens in the description of the time from the atom, which chapter number is that? Somewhere around 10, 11 in the third canto. It describes, it builds up the smallest passage of time, which is the time it takes a chuti or whatever to combine into an atom, and it builds up time until the time of where Brahma's life, step by step, it builds up frames of references of time. So we look at Brahma's life ultimately as a flash of lightning over the ocean. And then, looking at Brahma's life, which is billions of years long, as a flash of lightning over the ocean, who can complain about what's happening to them for 10 minutes or 15 minutes or even 1 year or 10 years? So that's a very important point in judging what's good and what's bad in this world. And it's very hard to do this. When we look at it from the frame of reference of eternity, what's good for us and what's bad for us takes on a different flavor. And a catastrophe and a blessing takes on a different dimension if we look at it from the point of view of eternity. And in the fourth canto, what chapter is very clearly, you want to become renounced from everything as soon as you read these chapters. Paranjana, yes, immediately. Who cares about anything? So in the jaws of this time, the serpent of time, very vivid example. Just imagine that each and every one of us at some point over the last 100 billion years has been a creature in the mouth of a serpent, literally, not even figuratively like this. We've all had this experience. What does it mean to be within the jaws of a serpent if you're a mouse? Just imagine the terror in the heart. It means death very soon. So one who is in the jaws of the serpent, a mouse, how can he be thinking about protecting another? How he can't even protect himself. How can he protect another even? Above, Prabhupada explains about halfway through the purport, above the modes of nature is eternal time, which is called kala, because it changes the shape of everything in the material world. Even if we are able to do something temporarily beneficial, time will see that the good project is frustrated in course of time. The only thing possible to be done is to get rid of eternal time, kala, which is compared to kala sarp, or the cobra snake, whose bite is always lethal. No one can be saved from the bite of a cobra. The best remedy for getting out of the clutches of the cobra-like kala or its integrity, the modes of nature, is bhakti yoga, as is recommended in the Bhagavad Gita 14:26. What verse is that? Say the whole verse. Mam chayo charena bhakti yogena sevate sagunan brahmabhuyaya kalpate. Arise, by unflinching devotional service, one can transcend the modes and time. The highest perfectional project of philanthropic activities is to engage everyone in the act of preaching bhakti yoga all over the world. Listen to that again. Are you reading that right now, Adi Purush? Could you read it out loud, loudly? Huh? The highest perfectional from there. Now imagine, what is that? The highest philanthropic activity. Is it going to be feeding the poor? Well, if you're looking at it the perspective of one day or 2 weeks or 3 weeks or a month or 2 years or 10 years or even 80 years, yes, it might be opening hospitals. But looking at it from the point of view, the viewpoint of eternity, which is where Prabhupada speaks from, what is this highest perfectional project of philanthropic activities? From the point of view of eternity, and it is very difficult to remain if one isn't on that level, always looking at things. It's not difficult, it's impossible. But this is reality. Reality is eternal time, from the point of view of eternal time. And what is real welfare work is helping people get out of the clutches of eternal time. What verse in the Bhagavatam describes this in Gopi Gita? Who is the most munificent welfare worker? You know, yeah? Tapta jivanam kavibhiraditam kamasam. Because it is Srimaratitam, this Bhagavatam, full of potencies. How could you? So he's chastising them. Chastising them. But of course, Yudhisthira's illusion is caused by Krishna. Yudhisthira actually has no attachment. There's one verse that we've already heard earlier in the 13th chapter, the 6th verse, where describes in the 13th chapter, O Brahmanas, the opulence of the king, Yudhisthira, was so enchanting that the denizens of heaven aspired for it. But because he, Yudhisthira, was absorbed in the service of the Lord, nothing could satisfy him except the Lord's service. So he wasn't in the same position as Dhritarashtra at all. That's the 6th verse. It also describes, I'll say that later. So then Yudhisthira is thinking, okay, what happens if, yes, everyone's in the serpent, under the control of the serpent of time, but what happens if he'll just get eaten by an animal or something? He's out there in the forest, the jungles, alone. So in reply to that, what will he eat? On one level, what would he eat? And on another level, what happens if he gets eaten? So then the next verse, a famous verse, Anahastani sahastranam apadanani chitaspadam falguni tatamahatam jivo jiva sujivanam. So what will happen? This is natural nature's law. This is the way life is. Those who are devoid of hands are prey for those who have hands. Those who are devoid of legs are prey for the four-legged. The weak are the subsistence of the strong. And the general rule holds that one living being is food for another. So what will happen? He'll find something to eat. This is the law of nature out there. And if he gets eaten by a tiger, what to do? This is the law of nature. So, yeah. So this was Narada's way, as Prabhupada explains in the purport. No one should be very anxious for his subsistence in any circumstances, because there are living beings everywhere, and no living being starves for want of food at any place. Maharaj Yudhisthira is advised by Narada not to worry about his uncle suffering for want of food, for they could live on vegetables available in the jungle as prasada of the Supreme Lord, and thus realize the path of salvation. Continue. Therefore, instead of focusing your mind in lamentation and anxiety about those you think that are dependent upon you and who you're protecting, what should you do? 48. O King, you should look to the Supreme Lord only, who is one without a second and who manifests himself by different energies and is both within and without. You should look towards the Lord. You should focus your mind only upon Him. Halfway through with Prabhupada's purport. There is, however, a regular current from the Lord Himself, from within and without, by which to rectify the fallen condition of the living being. From within He corrects the desiring living being, His localized Paramatma, and from without He corrects by His manifestations, the spiritual master and the revealed scriptures. One should look into the Lord. One should not be disturbed by the so-called manifestations of happiness and distress, but he should try to cooperate with the Lord in his outward activities for correcting the fallen souls. There, in a few sentences, is the entire Bhagavad Gita. By his order only, one should become a spiritual master and cooperate with the Lord. One should not become a spiritual master for one's personal benefit, for some material gain, or as an avenue of business or occupation for earning livelihood. Bona fide spiritual masters who look unto the Supreme Lord to cooperate with Him are actually qualitatively one with the Lord, and the forgetful ones are perverted reflections only. Yudhisthira Maharaj is advised by Narada, therefore, not to be disturbed by the affairs of so-called happiness and distress, but to look only unto the Lord to execute the mission for which the Lord has descended. That was his prime duty. So who is that Lord that one should look towards, who is one without a second, and who manifests himself by different energies, who's both within and without? Who is that Lord? That Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna, in the guise of all-devouring time, Kalarupa, has now descended on earth to eliminate the envious from the world. Kalosmin Loka Chaya Krit. His Kalarupa, he has descended. For whom he has descended? To remove them from the world, the burden of the earth. Sridhar Swami comments on this verse on 49, he says, the question is, how does one look either toward or away from someone who is all-pervading? Sridhar Swami comments, look to the Lord, but where is he now? The answer is, in Dwarka. He has assumed the form of destroyer, Kalarupa, but his real form is of bliss. And Prabhupada, in his purport, explains For the devotees, his factual form is disclosed. And for the non-devotees, he appears like Kalarupa, which is causal form. This causal form of the Lord is not at all pleasing to the asuras, and therefore they think the Lord is formless in order to feel secure that they will not be vanquished by the Lord. But for the devotees, they see him in his transcendental form and appreciate that. Text 50. The Lord has already performed his duties to help the demigods, and he is awaiting the rest. You Pandavas may wait as long as the Lord is here on earth. So is the Lord still here on earth? No, he's actually gone. But like Vidura, Narada would not disclose this to the Pandavas directly. But indirectly, he's saying, you perform your duty. He's here. You should look to him in your duty in his service. Should surrender to that. And you should wait here on earth for as long as the Lord is on earth. And then that will be your signal for it's the time for you to depart. As soon as you know that the Lord has departed, then it will be your time. You'll know that it's time for you to depart. So there's his hint, Narada Muni's hint in that regard. In regard to text 47, where Narada says, Jivo Jivas Jivanam, Shira Shira Swami has commented, don't think, how will Dhritarashtra maintain his life without my shelter? That's Dhritarashtra's comment. That is not a proper way to think. And Jiva Goswami comments, even if they are devoured by a tiger, one need not lament for them. Hare Krishna. Very, very strong, heavy preaching. You be detached. You become attached only to Krishna. Look only to him. Don't think you're the one who's doing it, the controller, the maintainer. Don't think like this. To Dhritarashtra, don't think that you're being maintained by others. You take shelter of Krishna. Depend on him, to Yudhisthira. Don't think that you're the one maintaining anyone. This is all done by Krishna. You're like a mouse in a snake's jaws. How can you maintain anyone? But yet, in both cases, one should do one's duty for Krishna's pleasure and not be inactive. Now, text 51. Now, it's Srila Swami commented back further to text way back in 41. He commented that Narada Muni wanted to rescue Yudhisthira Maharaj from grief. That was his actual purpose. He wanted to rescue him from his grief by telling him of Dhritarashtra's fate. And now, after the preaching has been done, he's going to tell him of what actually happened and will happen to Dhritarashtra. So he wanted to remove his grief. That's what a sadhu's only business was. Sometimes it appears that it's cutting, but his only desire is actually to remove grief. But he first wished to preach to Yudhisthira about the identity of he who is actually the controller. So 51. So after the philosophy, what happened to Dhritarashtra? Narada continues to speak to Yudhisthira. O king, your uncle Dhritarashtra, his brother Vidura, and his wife Gandhari have gone to the southern side of the Himalayan mountains, where there are the shelters of the great sages. This place where they have gone is called Saptaruta, divided by seven. Is this Saptarishi? Also, is that what it's called now, Saptarishi up there? Anyone know? I don't know. Divided by seven, because there. Yes, I wouldn't be surprised, because there, right now there's the place called Saptarishi up there, and clearly on any map near Badrinath, you see that, yes? This place is called Saptarota, divided by seven, because there the waters of the sacred Ganges were divided into seven branches. This was done for the satisfaction of the seven great rishis. On the bank of the Saptarota, at Saptarota, Dhritarashtra is now engaged in beginning Astanga Yoga by bathing three times daily in the morning, noon, and evening, by performing the Agnihotra sacrifice with fire, and by drinking only water. This helps one control the mind and the senses and frees one completely from thoughts of familial affection. One who has controlled the sitting postures, the asanas, and the breathing postures can turn the senses process, pranayama, can turn the senses towards the Absolute Personality of Godhead, so that's pratyahara, and thus become immune to the contaminations of the modes of material nature, namely mundane, goodness, passion, ignorance. So Dhritarashtra, at this very moment, where you are lamenting about him, who'll take care of him, he is in this Saptarishi place, and he is practicing very heavy austerities of Astanga Yoga, controlling his mind and becoming detached fully from the material world. Dhritarashtra will have to amalgamate his pure identity with intelligence and then merge into the Supreme Being with knowledge of his qualitative oneness as a living entity with the Supreme Brahman. Being free from the blocked sky, he will have to rise to the spiritual sky. We'll read from the last half of Prabhupada's purport. One has to realize that qualitatively he is non-different from the Supersoul, and thus he transcends the material sky by his pure, identical intelligence, and thus becomes engaged in the transcendental loving service of the Lord. This is the highest perfectional development of spiritual identity, which was attained by Dhritarashtra by the grace of Vidura and the Lord. The Lord's mercy was bestowed upon him by his personal contact with Vidura, and when he was actually practicing the instructions of Vidura, the Lord helped him to attain the highest perfectional stage. He will have to suspend all the actions of the senses, even from the outside, and we will have to become impervious to interactions of the senses, which are influenced by the modes of material nature. After renouncing all material duties, he must become immovably established beyond all sources of hindrances on the path. Prabhupada's purport, we'll read the first half. Dhritarashtra had attained by the yogic process the stage of negation of all sorts of material reaction. The effects of the material modes of nature draw the victim to indefatigable desires of enjoying matter, but one can escape such false enjoyments by the yogic process. Every sense is always busy in searching for its food, and thus the conditioned soul is assaulted from all sides and has no chance to become steady in any pursuit. Maharaj Yudhishthira was advised by Narada not to disturb his uncle by attempting to bring him back home. He was now beyond the attraction of anything material. O King, he will quit his body most probably on the fifth day from today, and his body will turn to ashes. So there is no need to go bring him back. And there was no need to even bring his body back. Because Yudhishthira may be thinking, at least I should go to perform the funeral ceremony for him. The next verse explains there's no need even for that. And then there's no need even to bring back Gandhari or even perform a funeral ceremony for her. Because, as Narada Muni explains further, while outside observing her husband, who will burn in the fire of mystic power along with his thatched cottage, his chaste wife will enter the fire with rapt attention. The first half of Prabhupada's purport. Gandhari was an ideal chaste wife, a life companion of her husband, and therefore when she saw her husband burning in the fire of mystic yoga along with his cottage of leaves, she despaired. She left home after losing her 100 sons, and in the forest she saw her most beloved husband was also burning. Now she actually felt alone. And therefore, she entered the fire of her husband and followed her husband to death. This entering of a chaste lady into the fire of her dead husband is called the sati rite, and the action is considered to be most perfect for a woman. Prabhupada explains in the purport that a lady who was in previous times, especially, that had so much love for the husband, and when he would die, the pain of being separated from him, the burning pain of being separated from him, was more painful than the pain of the burning of the fire. But, as Prabhupada explains in the purport, to force someone into doing this is most abominable. And therefore, he said it was properly abolished by the British. He explains this somewhere else. Yes, here he explains it. But then Yudhisthira may think that at least I should go and take care of Vidura. I cannot help Dhritarashtra Gandhari, but at least let me take care of Vidura. Shouldn't I go? And then he explains, Narada explains, Vidura, being affected with delight and grief, will then leave that place of sacred pilgrimage. Having spoken thus, the great sage Narada, along with his Veena, ascended into outer space. Yudhisthira kept his instructions in his heart and was able to get rid of all lamentation. So let me just read the next to last purport to 59 about Vidura and his mood. Vidura was astonished to see the marvelous departure of his brother Dhritarashtra as a liberated yogi, for in his past life he was much addicted to materialism. Of course, it was only due to Vidura that his brother attained the desirable goal of life. Vidura was therefore glad to learn about it, but he was sorry that he could not make his brother turn into a pure devotee. This was not done by Vidura because of Dhritarashtra's being inimical to the Pandavas, who are all devotees of the Lord. An offense at the feet of the Vaishnava is more dangerous than an offense at the lotus feet of the Lord. Vidura was certainly very liberal to bestow mercy upon his brother Dhritarashtra, whose past life was very materialistic. But ultimately, the result of such mercy certainly depended on the will of the Supreme Lord in the present life. Therefore, Dhritarashtra attained liberation only, Dhira, not Narottam. And after many such liberated states of life, one can attain the stage of devotional service. Vidura was certainly very mortified by the death of his brother and sister-in-law, and the only remedy to mitigate such lamentation was to go out to pilgrimage. Thus, Maharaj Yudhisthira had no chance to call back Vidura, his surviving uncle. I think it seems to me from looking at Prabhupada's purports, and there was one other where he almost said that he went back to Godhead too. So it seems like Prabhupada takes in different contexts, the situation and preaches in a more general way than directly always describing exactly what specifically happened to Dhritarashtra. So in general, what verse is that? Samahatma Sadolava Mahunam Janamanante Yanamam Papadyante. So after many, many births of understanding that Krishna is all pervading, and which perhaps is the realization of a jnani, then one who is fortunate can understand that it is Krishna, Vasudeva Savami. He is everything. After many births of being a jnani and understanding how everything is one, or Brahman is all pervading, then one may understand that it is all pervading, but through Krishna's expansion of Vasudeva, and then one becomes a devotee and surrenders. So it seems to me that Prabhupada is making one point that the perfection in the earlier purport is making. The point that the perfection of yoga is ultimately to become a devotee, and in this one he's talking about liberation in relationship to devotional service, sort of general preaching points that he's taking the opportunity of the occurrences that are happening to Dhritarashtra to make. That's what it seems. Oh, which one? Oh, you mean because it should be past tense. Printing, I don't know, but it's... Because imminent means just now going to happen, basically. But it's clear it's already happened. Yes. I'm not sure what you mean. What you want to look up imminent? Do you have a... And it's clearly already happened because Vidura passed through Prabhachetra after it happened. Yes. You know what Sukuni means? I happened to come across it recently. Anyone know what Sukuni means? It means vulture. And also, it's ultimately pastime. Anyway, I wouldn't vote for him myself. But he didn't, he actually died in front of Krishna. But this is ultimately, I mean, the pastime energy of the Lord is involved in all this.
This was not achieved by Vidura.
Well, he said, but he was sorry, Vidura was sorry that he could not make his brother turn into a pure devotee. But then the next sentence is there. So there was something still in his heart that disallowed him, it sounded like, or Krishna from the point of view of Krishna. But in any case, whatever the little bit of intricacy in the pastime is, the message of the pastime is very clear, that we should avoid offending the Vaishnavas because it will really impede our going back to Godhead. So that's what I tend to do when reading in something that's really, really, I try to understand what's really being said and try to imbibe that, because if I get so involved in the details, then I'll have really missed the point anyway. And I find them Prabhupada's purports, just by the nature of where they are, it's really easy to get caught in some wording or some technical thing that doesn't quite work. But rather what I try to do is find out what he's saying, and take the gift that he's offering me from that, and try to deeply understand what that is and take it. And not, and of course I personally try to understand everything, and sometimes I can understand and sometimes I can't, but at least when I can't, at least try to imbibe what the real message of the is. Yes. Why did he call him that? Huh? Yes. What does it say in Monia Williams about Shakuni? Why did Dhritarashtra's mother call him Dhritarashtra, holding on to the kingdom, and Chitraleka, the picture drawer, and this one and that one? Yes. If you don't try to understand, if I don't try to understand something that I'm actually not able to understand, which is the mentalities of everyone in the spiritual world, but take it in the material world, clearly Krishna is more attached to us than we are to him, because he's pulling us back to him. So if we accept this point and see his love coming to us, that will, in so many different ways, even sometimes we get a slap by the material nature, but if we see that as Krishna's attachment for us and his affection for us and love for us, and see everything in this perspective, we accept as a prime principle that Krishna loves us so much, even though we may not be experiencing it. But through that vision, we look at the material world and everything that happens to us, that this is an expression of Krishna's love, will become very, very, very happy, satisfied, secure, and will end up with him in the spiritual world very, very quickly. And then you can send us an email and tell us about the upper way, who's more attached to who. Jai Prabhus, everything is really nice here. But I was thinking about that point recently, and it actually soothed my heart so much to think, just accept it as a principle that Krishna is more attached and very attached to us, and he wants us. And therefore, he sends mercy in so many ways, and practically speaking, he's sending mercy 24 hours a day, but we don't see it as mercy because we want mercy in this way and this way and that way. But he's sending the mercy that we need. So if we see everything as his mercy, then we will go back to Godhead. And that's the vision that we're being asked to develop. Yeah, and what Prabhupada has answered that question by saying, that is your mismanagement. In other words, the food is there, but if some government holds it back or something like that, or doesn't distribute the produce of the earth, or grows, instead of growing food, growing tobacco or something like that. That's how he's answered that question. First of all, there's three levels of offenses: mind, words, and actions. So Dhritarashtra committed the offenses on the actions, on the physically trying to kill the Pandavas many times, not even one time. So what can be done? So there's only one thing, as far as I understand. What is that one thing? No, we take shelter of the... Yes. Yeah, and have to do whatever is required to satisfy him. Or, if he's not present, then take shelter of the holy names.